You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, April 27th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Manisha Sinha on her book, The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. Also on the program today for members, Matt Lex, deep archive pick. I don't know what it is. He doesn't even let me know. It's so secret. Goes into a secret room and makes his decision. His listening, his cone of silence from the outside. From the inside, apparently, he can hear things. That's how he listens to the show. Folks, you're going to enjoy this one. It is a deep dive into the history of abolitionists and a fascinating look at the differences within that movement and a sort of a corrective for history that looks upon the abolitionist movement as one that is exclusively about white people doing black people a favor. There's movies like that. I can't remember what. Like the White Knight movies. Not literally called that.
Mississippi Burning is one of those.
Oh, it's all about Gene Hackman and about the. All right. Well, you will enjoy this movie. There's more that are less sort of like even historical based. I don't even know what it is. But. Well, what was that? Ken Howard. Ken Howard just died. He was a former SAG president, but it was about him being a white basketball coach at a black basketball school. It was literally called like the White Knight or something like the White. I don't know if that was based on a true story or what, but he always used to figure it out for those kids. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, enjoy this. Don't forget that it's your support that makes this show possible. So you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. But I'm telling you now, there are only 3 or 4 days left in April. I can't tell. And in the future, I'm recording this in the past. And in the future, April, I think, becomes flexible. I'm not exactly sure. I can't predict. All I can tell you is I know there's a very few days left in April. And you have an opportunity. This doesn't, I don't know if it's ever happened before. I don't know if it's ever going to happen again. 30% off of justcoffee.coop. You've heard me talk about it so many times. Maybe you're an old Air America fan and you heard Marin talk about it. Maybe you listen to WTF now and you hear Marin occasionally bring it up because it's such a legacy ad for him. They don't, you know, he's now moving on to like massive corporate, but not me. I have the opportunity to give you 30% off of Just Coffee. I'm going to do it with the coupon code MRSPRING16. MRSPRING16. 30% off Just Coffee. It costs no more than coffee. You could buy the worst coffee in the world at your supermarket. And, or you could buy fantastic coffee that is fair trade, that's the majority.fm blend if you want it. Have it shipped directly to your door. This is the time for you to try this coffee. You end up liking it, Maybe you just want to bet that you're going to like it. Buy pounds and pounds of it, folks. Store it in your fridge. Store it in your root cellar. I don't care. All right, so just head to justcoffee.coop, MRSpring16. And now here is, we'll take a quick break, come back with Manisha Sinha, and then members, stick around. Matt has some archive material for you. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor of History at UMass in Massachusetts. The author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. Manisha Sinha, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's, your book is a very comprehensive history of abolition, not just, I guess, in the United States, or I guess not just as it is expressed or influenced within the United States, but also transnationally. And it starts, give us a sense of how you, when you embarked on this, to write this book, how most history books were written in terms of telling the story of abolition. And whether you set out to correct that or just sort of began to realize that it needed some type of correction.
Yes. So I found that most of the histories of abolition that we have were somewhat out of date and fragmented. So many of these histories still saw abolitionists as a group of sort of radical individuals, rather than see them part of a broad-based movement that struggled against slavery. So most historians, I don't think, fully appreciated the role that abolitionists did played in pushing forward the subject of slavery and making it into a kind of a mass concern in the North. And so I set out to write a movement history, and I wanted to write it in a way that was not so fragmented. You know, many historians wrote about certain factions within the movement, whether they were followers of William Lloyd Garrison, or they were more religiously inclined, or they were political abolitionists. And recently, work had been done on women and blacks in the movement, but it hadn't really been integrated into a broader story of the abolition movement. And that is what really, got me started with this project, with this book project. And as I wrote it, I uncovered many new things about the movement.
And I want to get to those. So, but just give us a sense of I mean, on one level, we're the, when you say blacks in terms of obviously as slaves at that time, or as free people, or as how is that distinction made in terms of what we previously understood and what you've come to understand?
Okay, so, well, we know that 90%, over 90%, in fact, of African Americans before the Civil War were enslaved, mainly in the southern states. And we did not ever really look at the role of the enslaved themselves in the abolition movement. And I make an argument that slave resistance, whether it was the handful of rebellions and conspiracies that took place, but also the movement of fugitive slaves into the North, really played an important part in radicalizing the abolition movement and in determining its literature, its tactics, and its leadership. So when I looked at African Americans, of course I looked at free blacks in the North, who were a very tiny part of the Northern population, but were eager abolitionists, were publishing newspapers, pamphlets, and using independent churches and fraternal societies to advocate the cause of the slave. But I thought that in order to fully appreciate the black presence in the abolition movement, one had to look at the enslaved themselves. So, for instance, the people whom I call fugitive slave abolitionists, the most famous and well-known, of course, is Frederick Douglass. But there were scores like him, men and women, who fled to the North and joined the abolition movement and became its best advocates. They were the ones who were really able to refute the growing sophistication of the pro-slavery argument, where many slaveholders argued that they treated their slaves better than free white northern workers were treated in the North or in England, and that white northerners had no idea what they were talking about when they criticized slavery. Well, they couldn't really refute the testimony of former slaves that effectively, and they chose to ignore them. And historians also chose to ignore them, and except, as I said, for a few exceptional figures like Douglass, we haven't really fully understood the place of these fugitive slaves in the movement, the fact that they produced these slave narratives, their firsthand experiences of enslavement that became what I call the movement literature of abolition. So that was one way in which I think my book is a bit different than most histories of abolition. It emphasized the role of the enslaved themselves within the abolition movement.
What do you think accounts for that failure to examine the role of slaves and ex-slaves in the the abolition movement?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that African-American history, at least in mainstream academy, you know, I'm not talking about African-Americans themselves who wrote black histories, you know, from the get-go, and they wrote outside the academy mainly, or in journals and in locations mainly devoted to black history. But you really saw the flowering of African-American history only since the civil rights movement. Before that, you have a, what I call a whitewashed view of the abolition movement. So we are only now seriously appreciating the role of African-Americans within the movement. One of the first books on black abolitionism was written as late as the 1970s. But I also think it has something to do with the fact that Southern slaveholders and their conservative allies in the North tended to write out the black presence from the abolition movement. And many of the early historians of the Civil War tended to be what we call revisionists. They downplayed the role of slavery in the coming of the war, and they certainly did not look at African-Americans themselves. So that historiography was pretty entrenched till very late. And as far as abolition is concerned, even some modern-day historians continue to sort of have the same kind of prejudices against the movement that their contemporary critics entertained.
So, I mean, I can understand from the perspective of the revisionists coming out of the Civil War and from histories that were coming out of the Southern tradition that you'd want to mitigate the problems of slavery. I mean, frankly, I mean, we still hear that in popular culture at times, right? I mean, that
exactly.
There was, yeah. I mean, so one can only imagine that it was there and even more present over the past 150 years or so. But in terms of the histories that were written from the North, was there a certain amount of, I mean, I don't know, you see this in films, I can't point to one right now, but it's the white savior, right, that that comes in. I mean, there was it a, and I know, obviously, you can't delve into the intent of these histories, but I wonder if in the course of examining them, whether you saw that sort of notion of wanting to make the abolitionists, particularly the white abolitionists, as sort of more heroic than they were? Is it that there's a general tendency to want to diminish what I think, you know, I guess maybe it's not an accurate descriptor, but the dynamic seems similar, to sort of downplay the role of the populist, you know, the of like mm-hmm. a populist uprising. I mean, do you have a sense of where that came from?
Well, I think part of it has to do also with the way in which people wrote history, where they concentrated on the great figures, on the right. individual figures. And I think a movement perspective, seeing abolition as a radical, interracial, social movement, goes away from that. So my book is not only about African-American abolitionists. I think a very important part of the movement is, in fact, its interracialism and the alliances that were made within the abolition movement, but also more broadly, politically, later on with anti-slavery political parties. Many of the histories that were written, I think, from the Northern perspective, talked about people, of course, like Abraham Lincoln or the Republican Party that came into power, which at that time was the anti-slavery liberal party of black rights. I would tell your listeners that everything they know about the Democrats and Republicans today, they should just switch for the 19th century.
Right.
So they would talk about Lincoln's role, for instance, but they would not talk much about these activists who had been agitating for abolition for, 30 years, certainly. And if you look in the long durée, like my book does, then you could go right back to the American Revolution and look at early black writers and Quaker activists within the abolition movement. So I shy away a little bit from this notion that we must completely not ignore white abolitionists, that they were not important. And I think that is actually inaccurate. Many of the white abolitionists whom we know about, like William Lloyd Garrison, I think became radicalized by their contact with African Americans. They adopt, the black program of rejecting colonization, which was a favorite plan of many so-called anti-slavery moderates, of just repatriating black people back to Africa and getting rid not just of slavery, but also African Americans. They really adopted the program of black citizenship and the immediate abolition of slavery from African Americans. So I looked at the importance of African Americans, but I wanted to also highlight the role of many of the white men and women who joined the movement and became indispensable allies in the black struggle for freedom.
I think that's one element that I think, I don't know if people, casually stop to think about it, but there was a real difference between someone who did not believe in and wanted to end the institution of slavery versus someone mm-hmm. who thought that black people were people or they should share yeah. in the same rights as other people, as their fellow citizens. Right. I mean, those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great point. I think what distinguishes abolitionists and why we call them radical is because they believed in racial equality and black citizenship programmatically. Whatever their individual relationships with African Americans were, and some of them could be somewhat paternalistic, the fact remains that the movement created a space, the only space in antebellum America, which is so rigidly divided along lines of race, gender, and class, for people to interact and fight in a common cause. And this is something that was really important for abolition, that they were fighting not just for the destruction of slavery, but also for black equality. So you see these abolitionist campaigns that I talk about in my book to desegregate schools, to desegregate transportation in the North. So they are just as critical of Northern racism as they are of Southern slavery. And I think a lot of people don't know that or forget about it.
Right. Or I think people, probably tend to assume, if you're an abolitionist, if you were against slavery, it was because you recognized the humanity or the citizenship in some way of black people. And it just wasn't necessarily the case. And you talk about basically two different waves of the history of, I guess, the abolitionist movement. The first wave being from the Revolutionary War into the early, or I guess the 1820s, and the the second wave being from the second wave, which began in, I guess, around the Reconstruction, right?
Well, the second wave picking up actually right up from
the 1820s, right? Okay.
The rise of Black radicalism, right down to the Civil War.
So let's talk about.
I did want to write a chapter on Reconstruction, but I think my editors would have protested if I added another chapter to this rather large book.
So all right. So I'm sorry. So forgive me for I got those dates mixed up. But so in the first wave. This would be from the late 1700s to the 1820s or so.
Right.
Is it more just abolition versus sort of radical, as you call it, sort of this radical idea that not only should we not own slaves, but these people that we have perceived as have been our slaves, they should have the same rights as I do?
That's a great question, because that was somewhat the traditional understanding of abolition, that the really radical phase began in the 1820s and 1830s, you know, the three decades or so before the Civil War, when racial equality became a programmatic feature of the new abolition societies, the anti-slavery societies begun by people like Garrison, the Tappans, Theodore Weld, etc., and that African Americans were actually members of these societies. If you look at that earlier phase that you're talking about, you know, around the revolutionary era, which ended with gradual emancipation in the North and the end of the African slave trade, what you see are abolition and manumission societies in most of the states, except the Deep South states of Georgia and South Carolina. And these states, these societies rather, are all white. They're Quaker-dominated. African-Americans are not part of these societies until fairly late. And then also they're very few and far between. And the traditional idea was that these societies were far more paternalistic, did not really believe in Black citizenship. But I argue in my book that in their own way they did. They were not interracial and radical like the second wave. But in the first wave, I uncovered, and I think many recent historians are uncovering, a lot of connections between Black leaders, newly freed people in the North, newly freed Blacks in the North, and these abolition societies. They would go to them to make sure, for instance, to make sure that the emancipation laws are implemented, that slaveholders were not trying to sell people down South rather than emancipate them or violate some of these laws that were put into place. For instance, Sojourner Truth, who was a slave in New York, had her son sold down to Alabama and had to seek legal assistance from anti-slavery Quakers in order to recover her son. The other thing that I found interesting about these early abolitionists were that even though they were perhaps more paternalistic than the later radical abolitionists, they did visualize African Americans as eventual citizens of this country. So they really put all their efforts into education, opening schools, into what we call ideas of racial uplift, so that African Americans, newly freed African Americans, would in fact become part of this society. And some of them joined the colonization movement when it started later on, but most of them rejected it, and most of their organized societies did not like the idea of colonizing Black people back to Africa, as many anti-slavery politicians from Jefferson onwards had recommended. So even that earlier phase, it was not as if they were not committed to seeing African Americans become eventual citizens of the Republic, though they had a more gradual process in mind. They felt people had to be educated and trained into citizenship, and it was the way they approached emancipation too sometimes. So even though their tactics were somewhat different, the goals, the eventual goals were similar. So I find more continuity, between the first and second waves of abolition, than most historians do.
What were the role of slaves during the Revolution? I mean, that's got to be, I mean, that's an interesting dynamic, right? My master is fighting so that he's no longer a slave of the king.
Right.
As for me, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, African Americans, sought their freedom in whatever way that was possible. And during the Revolution, they see this opening where they fight on both sides to gain their freedom. Some simply run away with their families to gain their freedom because the British are offering freedom to black men if they fight on their side. Pretty soon, the Continental Army also catches up with that idea. Again, South Carolina and Georgia, the only two states that do not recruit African Americans, but most of the other states do. They also petition for their freedom. They sue for their freedom. And this was remarkable to me because if you look at a state like Massachusetts, freedom came to Massachusetts, rather slavery ended in Massachusetts because two slaves sued for their freedom. And there was a tradition in Massachusetts of slaves suing for their freedom, but that process increases during the Revolution, where many enslaved people evoke the rhetoric of revolutionary ideology, of natural rights, to claim their own freedom. And in fact, in 1783, when Massachusetts abolishes slavery, it's through a court decision because two slaves had chosen to sue their masters for their freedom.
Was that the first state? Was that the first state that had declared slavery, I guess, illegal in the state?
No, Vermont was the first one. And as usual, Vermont was ahead, I think, probably still is the most progressive state in the Union. But Vermont abolished slavery immediately when it was formed as a state, you know, as from part of New York. It actually abolished slavery in its state constitution. So Vermont was the first one. The first law was actually passed in Pennsylvania, where Quaker anti-slavery is extremely strong. You had, you know, famous Quaker abolitionists like Anthony Benezet, John Woolman, and even earlier radicals like Benjamin Lay fighting against slavery. So Pennsylvania is the first state to pass a gradual emancipation law in 1780, and that becomes a model for other northern states. They pass these gradual emancipation laws that free the children of slaves and not the slaves themselves. And when, once they reach adulthood, the idea is that they are apprenticed and that they would receive some education. But in a way, they are also paying their masters with their labor.
Right.
So I write in my book that you can see gradual emancipation as one sort of state-sanctioned self-purchase scheme,
right,
where black men and women had to serve their masters till they reached majority, different ages in different states, in order to win their freedom.
I'm in Pennsylvania, obviously, the Quakers, there's a sort of a religious foundation for their anti-slavery legislation. What was it that, and if in Massachusetts it was a sort of a more, I guess, civic-based, right, argument that is takes place in the courts. What was it in Vermont that ensconced it in the charter? What was generating this anti-slavery, I guess, disposition?
Well, I think it certainly was the revolution era and you know, the rhetoric of revolution and natural rights, etc. But even here, it was not as if this was inevitable. You know, people had to fight in order to make these rights apply to them. So African Americans were rather critical, actually, of colonists and patriots who were fighting. They sort of indicated for more trivial reasons rather than they who were genuine slaves in the United States. So I think part of it has to do with the fact that African Americans themselves took advantage of revolutionary ideology to fight for their own freedom. And even beyond the United States, you know, the truly abolitionist revolution, of course, was not the American Revolution, because even though freedom eventually comes to the North, the southern states, slavery does not only not die out, but it actually expands. The truly abolitionist revolution that we often forget was, in fact, the Haitian Revolution, which began as a slave rebellion and ended up with the founding of the first modern black republic. And what I found in my research was that the Haitian Revolution became a source of inspiration for abolitionists as an example of immediate radical abolition, as an example of, black citizenship. And many abolitionists, both black and white, look to Haiti as a successful example of revolutionary abolition. So these things were contested, and that's why I keep emphasizing activism and a movement perspective. It was not as if, because, we know there were, many of our founding fathers were, in fact, slaveholders.
Right.
And believed in the rhetoric, at least, of liberty, but continued to hold their slaves in the South. The only sort of prominent founding father who frees his slave on his death is George Washington. None of the others, Jefferson, Madison, Henry, none of them free their slaves, and none of them joined the abolition movement or lend the prestige of their name to the abolition movement as some did in the North, people like John Jay, Alexander Hamilton. I am really happy that Hamilton is finally getting his due a little bit because, people say his anti-slavery is exaggerated, but he did, in fact, join the Manumission Society and did advance the cause. Anti-slavery.
And just so people know, the Haitian Revolution is the late 18th century, the early 19th century, right? The late, the end of around 1800, essentially. So,
So 1791 to 1804.
So in terms of, Vermont, so is there a dual track here in terms of what is driving abolition? Is sentiment, I guess, both on one hand, a religious component, on another hand, a civic component. Are these dual tracks? Are they one track and in one place how does that break out?
Yeah.
Because, it's interesting because on one level, it seems like not only have the Democrats and Republicans switched since the 1800s in the Civil War, but this notion of almost like identity politics that is emanating out of Christianity also flips in some ways. Maybe I'm reading too much into that, but I there just seems to be a parallel there.
Well, it is interesting that the evangelicals I studied within the abolition movement, the religiously inspired, and the Quakers were not so evangelical, but the later, the Baptists, the Methodists, the anti-slavery components of those denominations tended to be very progressive and liberal in their views. So you are absolutely right. They actually have flipped positions because the people today who identify themselves as evangelicals are associated with denominations like the Southern Baptist Convention that actually defended slavery in the 19th century. In fact, these denominations broke along sectional lines precisely over the issue of slavery. So the people today are far more fundamentalist. They have a literal reading of the Bible. The evangelical abolitionists that I studied, especially men like Theodore Weld, were very progressive and liberal in their views. They believed in women's rights, some of them, like Weld. They evoked much more the spirit of the Bible. And there was a political parallel there, too, where many abolitionists evoked the spirit of the Constitution and referred to the Declaration of Independence, while Southern slaveholders adhered to a strict construction and a literal reading of the U.S. Constitution, pointing to things like the Three-Fifths Clause or the Fugitive Slave Clause to say that slavery is recognized in the actual wording of the Constitution. So religiously, they have flipped too. What was interesting for me to see is that the Quakers tended to be radical, not just on the question of slavery, but also on questions of women's rights, Native American rights. They were critical of people who exploited labor in order to reap profits. They were pacifists, so they were against the wars to divest land from Native Americans. And this is, I'm talking just about the abolitionists, Quaker abolitionists, not talking about Quakers as a whole, because, you know, within Quakerism, abolitionists actually had to convince elites within their own denominations that slavery was wrong and that it ought to be condemned. And eventually the Quakers as a whole do that. And they're the first religious denomination, in fact, to make slaveholding a sin.
So it was a bottom-up type of, growth of this movement within the Quakers. Is that right?
Absolutely. If you look at some of the early Quaker abolitionists, they suffered. They were sometimes shunned. Benjamin Lay, one of my favorite Quaker abolitionists, would actually engage in tactics that we would call modern protest. He would stand barefoot in frost to make slaveholders acquainted with the fact that they do not clad their slaves properly. He once threw pokeberry juice, which is red, on the Bible to say that this is the blood of slaves, that you can't pretend to be good Christians when you're exploiting slaves in a cruel manner. He kidnapped the child of a Quaker slaveholder to acquaint him with the grief of African parents who had lost their children to the slave trade and slavery. So you know, he was fairly radical for his time. Many Quakers did not like his tactics. They many times shunned these people.
Mm-hmm. Putting tactics aside, but was his radicalism, mm-hmm. what did his Quakerism make him, more open to radicalism, or what was it radicalism which manifested itself in him through his Quakerism? And I'm not asking just necessarily for him.
Yeah.
I mean, because this to me seems like a fascinating point as to, because it's one thing, you know, if the spiritual leadership of the Quakers, to the extent that they mm-hmm. have any, I mean, mm-hmm. that elders are sort of encouraging this because it's consistent with Quakerism, as opposed to sort of the flock perceiving this, you know. I mean, I'm just curious as to which.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there's a little bit chicken and egg here, but because.
Yeah.
This is also true for the broader
question.
It's also true for the mm-hmm. broader a movement itself, right? It's like, how much it was radicalism, was abolition part of a radical agenda versus mm-hmm. Abolitionist, began to understand things that made them more open to a broader radicalism?
Right. No, I think it's an interesting question, because we know that many of the dissenting Protestant sects during the English Civil War, if you look at the foundations of Quakerism, there were other sects like the Ranters, the Diggers. They were against slavery. They believed in common ownership of property. They had fairly radical ideas for their time. So the founder of Quakerism, you know, George Fox, visits the West Indies, and he's discomfited by slavery. He advises in one of his earliest texts that, you know, that Quakers should think about educating their slaves, eventually freeing them, and even paying them for the years of uncompensated labor. He does not call for the abolition of slavery, but he is the founder, and he is already saying this. And then, of course, there are Quaker slaveholders in the British West Indies, even before, the British North American colonies are founded, who are uncomfortable with slavery and at times take their slaves with them to their meetings. They were not necessarily racial egalitarianism, but you could say that there was something within dissenting Protestant Christianity and particularly Quakerism that made them uncomfortable with slavery. What I found interesting about the abolitionists that I looked at in the early 18th century, in the colonies, in British North America, was that many of them subsumed their criticism of slavery under a broader critique of wealth making and commerce. They felt that this kind of pursuit of riches, as they put it, was demeaning their faith. They were uncomfortable with the wars against Native Americans because Quakerism, of course, believes in pacifism. So immediately you can see right from the origins that a critique of slavery was tied to some of the other causes. We normally don't think of abolitionists as true radicals in that sense. We think of them as just fixated on the issue of slavery. And indeed, they thought that slavery was the most glaring evil of their society. But they connected the slave's cause with other evils in their society. So in that respect, I feel they were true radicals. And I think you're right. The movement itself tended to encourage these radicals who would otherwise be seen and were seen, in fact, as outcasts in society. You found, you know, this sort of taking hold in organizations, in contact with African Americans. You know, you see these colonial slave rebellions that parallel the rise of Quaker protest. Many Quaker abolitionists point to rebellions and point to slaves running away, saying that this whole myth that slaves are contented, as Benjamin Lay says, is what he called a parcel of hypocrites and liars and deceivers. He called slaveholders because he pointed to instances of slave resistance to show that people of African descent were longing and fighting for their own freedom. So even at this point, you can see the beginnings of that kind of interracialism. Lay is a pacifist, he's a Quaker, but he says, you know, if there's a slave rebellion, we cannot blame them. And he says that as a Quaker, he will say no more, but he clearly understands that slaves are struggling for their own freedom. So in that sense, I think the movement was radical in ideology, and as it gets off the ground, it becomes more organized. It increasingly has to deal with questions of citizenship, racial equality, you know, what happens to people after slavery, with some Quaker abolitionists saying, you must compensate the slaves, right. Give them land, give them tools, give them some kind of freedom dues, which were normally given to indentured servants. So you can see that radicalism emerging and becoming more and more part of the abolitionist ideology.
And that's true with secular abolitionists as well, right? I mean, do I hear you correctly on that, or is it different? In other words, do radicals come to the cause of abolition, or do abolitionists become more radicalized as they start to sort of say, like, okay, what happens after we free these slaves?
But I think radicals come to the cause of abolition. So if you look at someone like Thomas Paine, you know, we all know Thomas Paine because of Common Sense and his call for American independence. But Paine was critical of the existence of slavery. And Paine, as you know, ends up as an atheist, even though he's the son of a Quaker staymaker. He's a Quaker staymaker, so he has Quaker origins. But they tend to be iconoclastic. The radicals come to the movement, and I think the movement attracts outsiders, what I call passionate outsiders, women, blacks. Most abolitionists tended not to be well-to-do or wealthy. They tended to be the humbler sort. So the first abolition society founded by Quakers, though I argue in my book that it was preceded by this anti-slavery committee and Sons of Africa in the North, these freedom petitioners who formed themselves into anti-slavery committees in the 1770s in New England. But the first Quaker abolition society that is founded in Pennsylvania in 1775 is founded by a tailor. Many of the Quaker abolitionists I looked at were indentured servants themselves. They tended to be people who could empathize with the plight of slaves. So I did see this, you know, both the secular, the religious sort of coming together, but it was a radicalism that held them together. And they differed with one another. They sometimes, as you know, later on, quarreled over different issues like women's rights. But it was a radical mindset that led people into abolition.
It's a fascinating history. The book is The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. Manisha Sinha, we will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for having me.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.